A quick word from our sponsor. Are you having trouble getting your design system to work for everyone in your business? Well, with Zero Height, you can have a central place where designers, engineers, product, brand, content folks, they can all come together and they can talk the same language to make your design system as successful as it can be. From documentation to token management to governance features, Zero Height is the most robust design system tool on the market today. And you can try it out for free at zeroheight.com. Now back to the show.
On today's show, we're going to be talking about accessibility and design systems. How much do design systems help with accessibility? Are they the key to inclusivity? Or is WCAG more like WBLIT? I'm Luke Murphy, and I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Chin. We're both design advocates at Zero Height, the design system management platform. And this is Design Systems WTF. Oh, back for, I can't even remember what episode this is. Episode 5?
Yeah, episode number 5.
Wow. We're seasoned professionals at this now. we're finally talking about an important topic. So accessibility, which I know is a passion of yours, right?
Yeah, I kind of fell into it. Like I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, so a lot of my jobs were for federal government-related products, and they all had to be accessible, so Section 508 compliant, which is like the government's version of accessibility, which basically kind of is do whatever WCAG does. And so I learned a lot that way, and I don't know, it's evolved quite a bit, so there's always more to learn. I don't know everything as a maestro.
Well, that is the thing, right? Because we're on WCAG 2.2, I believe is the current.
Yeah, one just got solidified and launched in October.
Yeah, is it ratified? Is that the right? I don't know. It's kind of like, but it's one of those things where it's like 2.2 has been in the works for years, and 3.0 is currently in draft. But I mean, that's not expected for at least another like 3-4 years, is it? I think they're predicting
at the earliest. Yeah, it's just like it the whole process, and like I can understand why it takes so long, but like it is like molasses compared to everything else in tech, right? Like, yeah.
I mean, I think it's pretty similar to the standardization process, right? You know, all the W3C stuff, where it's like I think the time between HTML4 and HTML5 was about 10 years. It's ridiculous, but at the same time, you know, there's a lot that goes into these things, and I think that it is, you know, it's important to be thorough, especially when you've got so many people using them as the standards and the guidelines for everybody to adhere to make sure that your site is accessible. So in terms of that accessibility, like what do you think are the most, just for somebody who's like, what? I doubt that there's many people, but for like, what is this accessibility thing? What, like in layman's terms, what do you say is like the most important areas of accessibility?
Yeah, so I think like backing up a little bit, like accessibility is just making sure everyone can use the web and accomplish their tasks and understand what's going on. And some people might need more assistance or alternative ways to do certain things like navigate, because maybe you can't use a mouse, but you can use a keyboard. Maybe you are colorblind and can't see, or you can't see as well. So you need to, there are tools like which are called assistive technology, also called AT, to help you accomplish your tasks and understand the web better. So that's kind of the whole like impetus of accessibility, is making it so there are no barriers to using the web and digital products. So I think, you know, there are different groups. So like there's like a, you know, making sure like in terms of like addressing vision impairments, hearing impairments, motor skill impairments, cognitive impairments. And so there's a whole range of within each of those sections that needs to be addressed. So just kind of making sure you're addressing those four sections. and in varying degrees. It sounds very overwhelming.
I mean, it's interesting because it's like I saw an amazing talk from Molly Watt a few years back at Beyond Telerand in Dusseldorf. And Molly Watt is a accessibility consultant who is also deafblind. And it was really interesting because the perspective that she was bringing was the fact that it's most people see it as very binary things, right? It's like, yeah, you are vision impaired, you are not vision impaired, you are hearing impaired, you are not hearing impaired. You have limited mobility, you have full mobility. And it's not, because it's, I mean, as Rue pointed out in the chat as well, it's like disability can be situational as well. Yeah. Like, you know, I've had friends before who have like types of light blindness where it's like during daylight, absolutely fine. Nighttime, can't see anything. So it's like very different, you know, situational dependencies. And I think it is one of those things where it's like, it is just, if you're not testing for accessibility, you are excluding people. So like, even just from we all know how much this podcast loves capitalism, but from like a capitalist point of view, you're excluding customers, which is probably not great business sense.
Yeah. I was at, I guess, I'm pulling this up really quickly. I was at Clarity a couple weeks ago, and Soren did a talk around accessibility and Ouija boards, because of the mysticism behind the two. But in there was a report in one of the slides, and this is like an older one because now it's like even the number's even higher, but like in 2021, it looks like there was a report that was released about civilians or just like people in the U.S. workforce that are of working age, so between 18 and like 65, that like 34% of people had some sort of disability. The number is actually even higher now in the most recent report. I don't know what it is, but I think, yeah, it's just like, it's not that just like, oh, you know, a few people need things. It's like a lot of people need things. Kind of like how Ray pointed out that we're both wearing glasses. Like, oh my gosh, if I didn't have my glasses, I would not be able to get very far. Well, I would injure myself and probably be dead. But yeah, and then it's also like, you know, there's like an intersectionality too. Like, yeah, like having glasses, being neurospicy, and, you know, other, and I also have a temporary disability. I got like, you know, I had a little procedure yesterday, and so now I can't move my arm as well, right? So it's just like everyone's gonna have something. And I think especially when we get all, like all of us get older, we're gonna want to have accessibility in place, so we can continue to thrive.
And so design systems, do you think that, I mean, it's a silly question, because I think that it is, it's pretty much a given, but it's like the accessibility should be baked in at the design system level, because it's like, if you're making your components accessible and you're actually testing it and testing it thoroughly at that level, then it's going to make sure that accessibility is baked into your product, right?
For the most part, like, I think it gets you a good percentage of the way there, but like, you still, like, individual screens need to have, like, so for example, like reading order, which is show and navigation order of like when you're using a keyboard only or you're using a screen reader to read the screen, that's not something a design system can necessarily define. Like, it could be, it's a case by case basis. I mean, maybe with some patterns and defining some patterns, you can establish some direction that way. But depending on like maybe if it's a form, there's a lot of different fields and other stuff, like the designer would have to determine the navigation order or what the experience should be if you're using a screen reader. So at the very bare bones, yeah, components and stuff, you can make them so they're accessible, and that just makes gives you a head start on making the product accessible. But it only gets you, I don't even know how much percent, I would maybe like say 75% of the way there, if I had to guess. But a lot of it is based on like the actual screen itself. And I think that's the thing, is a common misconception is like, oh, we can make our product accessible if we make the design system accessible and that's done. Like, there's no, we don't need to do anything else. But it's like, no, that's not true. Like I just said. So I think that's like, some people just assume design system accessible, check, the box is checked, right? But it's not. Like,
and that's the other thing too, is that it's like people quite often assume that it's just color contrast check. Make sure that it, you know, has the double A or triple A pass, and then done. And maybe if you're lucky, and it's keyboard navigable. Like that's like the next thing. I suppose I think one of the advantages of design systems and the type of people who tend to work on design systems as well is that you do at least have the benefit of design system devs, especially, tend to be a lot better with like semantic markup and making sure that things are done in a structured way that is good for, like, that's inherently good for screen readers, right? But even like the, you know, making things keyboard navigable is not out of the box a lot of the time. And I think it is. It's one of those things where it's like, I think what you said is right, right? Like you need to be testing. It's like you need to be testing. You need to be properly testing components, not just running them through automated checkers. Doing actual user testing.
Ideally, like manually. Yeah.
With users who, you know, have a variety of needs, like a representative user base, user testing panel. But then also you want to be doing that once it's in the product as well, so that you can double check that. Do you think it's better to just wait until it's in the product?
Oh yeah. Maybe, you know, wait until you get a customer complaint. No, I think like the thing is like, and I want to say not user testing, but it's usability testing, right? Like you're not testing the actual user itself or themselves, but like you're testing the product itself for accessibility. So, I think if you can get ahead, like it's always going to be better to do some usability testing before things get into the product. And you know, you'll find some stuff in the product maybe later on, but the more you can get ahead of it, the easier it becomes. And the less buggy and refactoring you'll have to do. And then like the actual like testing, like it's, I think there's a lot of like nice tools out there, which I think are a good like gut check and reminder, but just to make sure you didn't forget anything, but you can't really rely on them like wholeheartedly. Like I think it can help a little bit, but like the manual testing is really, really important. So it does take a little practice, but I think it's also a really good skill set for designers and engineers to have, to like, you know, what's it like to go through my product with a screen reader? What's it like to use a screen reader and keyboard navigation? And does this really work? And you're not testing. So like, I think that's the thing, is like the tools and stuff that you can like run sites through will test like the thing at a very like logical semantic level, but as it's not thinking about the design and the user experience. So like as if you do testing manually, you're like, is this the experience I want someone to have?
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, this is way too much, or this isn't working, or I'm confused as to where I'm going. This is not the experience as a designer I wanted to curate. So I think that's also where it comes into, like, people are very, okay, let me just check the check boxes to get this out of the way. But like, we have to remember that we are designers and we want to design good experiences. And that doesn't always equate to checking all the check boxes, right? So
yeah, exactly. I think that's right. And it's because it is. It's like, just because something has, you know, checked the checkbox as well, doesn't mean that it's actually a pleasurable experience. Just because something can pass and still be deeply unpleasant. But it's like also the ways that we test for a lot of these things, especially when it comes to things like color contrast, aren't perfect. They're not good. Like there are a lot of things with the way that we test for color contrast, it doesn't have enough nuance in it to actually test it properly. So there are things that it can pass that don't pass, that are like actively uncomfortable for people. And there are things that fail that actually are completely fine. And I know that they are fixing a lot of this in WCAG 3 as well, in the way that they like test for things like color contrast. There's like different, I don't know, there's different algorithms they use. There's a new standard for testing color contrast, exactly. I think that'll be good. But it is one of those things where it's like actually talking to the end users is really important. And I think when you're doing that, you can either recruit yourself if you have UX research in-house, or use things like remote testing. And it's basically just around doing decent screener questions. A lot of these, especially the remote, like audience recruitment like user testing recruitment services will probably have a lot of demographic detail in there that you can use. But if they don't have anything and you're looking for specific things to test against, just do a screener question and make sure that you're building a panel that accurately represents, you know, a wide slew of people. Otherwise, yeah. Agencies.
Because there's agencies that specialize in accessibility testing, like Fable, I think is one of them. But it will provide and I think the other thing is, like, when you do usability testing with people that have impairments, like, you need to, it's like there's like maybe like an extra level of understanding that you need to figure out it, to make sure that they have the proper accommodations and that they are going to be successful as well. So it can be get kind of specialized depending on what you're looking for. So sometimes going with another third party is helpful. I think one of my friends did a partnership with, there was like a school for the blind, and they partnered with them to do some usability testing. And also the kids got to learn about what it's like to work in tech. And that was like a really fun experience for both the students and the employees, because it's like the employees got to build a lot of empathy, understand how people navigate their daily lives when they don't have sight. So and it was like fun because they were kids, and like the kids got to learn about like what it's like to work in a tech field, like what do you do, and just understanding more of a career path. So that was pretty rad. So that you can even think about something like that. And then if you have like a employee resource group or a DEI, a diversity, equity, inclusion like department at your company, they might be able to point you in the right direction with some resources, or maybe some employees wouldn't mind trying out to test some of the stuff, because that's kind of cool too. I'm trying to look at the question. So Mateo asked, does it already happen to you that optimizing accessibility for a specific group has actually downgraded it for another group? So I think this is a common misconception, is that like, okay, when we make things accessible, it's just going to be really boring and bland for everyone else to use. And that doesn't have to be the case, right? So when designing for accessibility and making things accessible, it's making sure that there's like an alternative equivalent provided. So people should still make the innovations that they want to make in their apps and their sites, but there should be an alternative way for people who might not be able to use that innovation to get the same either task done, understanding, so they can still complete the action just like everyone else. So it's like kind of like an augmentation versus like a reduction in experience. I think the other thing is like, it's like alt text is a perfect example. Someone who doesn't have sight is never going to be able to look at a picture and understand it, but that doesn't mean you pull all your images off of the site or the app. You provide alternative text that kind of describes the gist of the image, so the people who can't see have an understanding of what's going on, and they're not missing out. So you don't have to reduce the experience by any means.
I was saying that it's about progressive enhancement, right? Like, it was the other way as well. Like you progressively, so you start off with a base that is accessible to everyone, and you add things on top that make it like better for the people who can sort of experience that, basically. And you keep kind of going, but you have to start with something that is functional, usable, like, and accessible, reliable, unlike some webinar platforms. Are there any other questions that have come through?
I don't think so. There's a lot of good thoughts coming through, which is good. If anyone has any questions, feel free to toss it in the chat.
I just want to say it out loud so that the folks at home can hear as well. I do love Ray pointing out the quote, when a lift fails, it's useless. When an escalator fails, it becomes stairs. And so we should be building escalators, not lifts. I think it's really nice. Practical examples of how Zero Height can help document accessibility. Well, actually, yeah, I, so basically documenting accessibility is around it is around doing the research and doing the doing the testing to make sure that it happened, like to make sure that what you're doing is accessible. In terms of how you can document that, I think that there's it's I don't think it needs to be bells and whistles. Putting it in a simple table and saying, you know, what colors work on top of what other colors, what the user testing has said, all those kind of things is like a good start. I don't know. Is there anything that you'd add in there, Michelle?
Yeah. So I learned this the hard way from experiences. Like I was writing the accessibility, like how each component was accessible. So like in your component page for like buttons, dropdowns, whatever, everything had a accessibility section. And then I'd be like, this component meets color contrast standards. This does this. And it was basically, I was repeating myself like 50 times. And I was like, this is insane. So I learned that if you can write like a one page, like kind of like with your foundations, it's kind of like a, like all the pages like around colors and, you know, voice and tone and all that, like you can have an accessibility page that says, you know, all of the things should have proper color contrast. This is the basic way to navigate. And then if there's anything special about a specific component, you can put that in the accessibility section on that page. And sometimes you can explain what I've seen other sites do is like, this is how we've made this accessible. But also this is where the designer needs to like add influence on how things are accessible. And sometimes the developer, there's also a developer section of like, this is what the developer is responsible for. Because you might not have complete accessibility with the component, depending on how it's used. The developer designer might need to do some different things. You can also explain like what kind of code you're using in terms of like ARIA labels, and attributes for that particular component, so the developer knows what to expect. So there's some details. So I would only put the specific details to that component on that page rather than just say, like, this meets color contrast. Like, you don't need to repeat yourself because then, God forbid, you have to, like, edit that, and it's a pain. So those are some ways you can definitely document it. Yeah, I think that's the thing. I noticed that, like, some people lean on, so Fritz mentioned documenting who's responsible for what is a good tip, because I think a lot of times people just assume, okay, oh yeah, the design system is accessible, my job is done, I don't have to do anything. But there are some things that you'll have to do, and it's good for people to know that, for sure. And Fritz asks, any thoughts on how to explain what doesn't work, what was tested and didn't work? I think, you know, a lot of times design systems focus on like, this is what we've decided and why. And here I go. I'm going to mention Dan Moll. So Dan Moll mentioned documenting patterns and kind of keeping your documentation set as like a way of journaling, so you can understand the context of why different decisions were made. So I think you can kind of journal that too, is like maybe have a separate section of like, this is what we did test and this is why it didn't work. So that historical knowledge is there, so people don't reinvent the wheel, or they can understand the thought process behind why the decisions were made, not just this is what you must consume and use. Because that might not be very, very straightforward, especially with some of the nuances of different impairments and accessibility tools.
I think it's one of those things where I know that we've debated internally from like a product point of view of like how much, you know, we automatically show when we're doing like version history on a component page or whatever to try and capture that decision log. But I think it's never going to be easily automated. And I do think that just literally keeping at the bottom of your documentation pages a little like decision log around, you know, the decisions that were made to do with that component is actually pretty helpful, or linking off to something else where you can, you know, if you have somewhere else that you capture meeting notes or whatever. But having something that is like searchable in that way is really good. I know that it's something that we've definitely like looked into how we can improve that at Zero Height too. So I'm sure that is something the product team are very on. But yeah, in terms of the actual the place for that in Zero Height, we're getting into just product stuff now. The place for that within Zero Height, I do think that just literally creating a new section at the bottom of the page is probably the easiest and like most straightforward way. Like, don't over-engineer it. Just put it in there and do it as like a bullet point list.
For a new tab. Yeah.
And then that's a good way where you can just start to log all the ways that you've used ChatGPT to try and assess your accessibility, because that's actually the future of accessibility testing. Nobody can tell sarcasm when I'm on here. It is fun playing with it. But that's completely a side point. And unfortunately, we've run out of time at that point. but definitely, I highly advise people go away, upload a screenshot of a button, and ask the generative AIs to produce you an accessibility report. It's quite fun how far it can get. That's all we've got time for today on the podcast, which is sad. But if you'd like to keep the conversations going, please come and join Zeros, which you can do, which is our Slack community, which you can do at zeroheight.com/Slack. I now have a channel in there specifically for the webinar. It's topic-designsystems.wtf. So you can come join that. At the moment, it's literally just me and Michelle. But hopefully you'll come and join so we can keep the chat going. If you've got any questions, please fire them over to us in there. If you've got any suggestions for the next episode, please contact us in there. You can email us at community@zeroheight.com, or you can contact us on X/Twitter, whatever we're calling it this week, @ZeroHeight. Until then, see you next time.
Yeah, thanks everyone.